Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Tonight on Speakers Forum, poetic inspiration. You may or may not know that when Town Hall Seattle opened its doors in March of 1999, the first gathering was a celebration of Seattle's favorite poems. The event was part of a national project created and hosted by then U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky. Last month, Robert Pinsky returned to Seattle to celebrate the 15th anniversary of that auspicious event. It was a fittingly lyrical night, introduced by KUOW's Marcy Silman and poet Heather McHugh. Whatever you're doing, set it aside, turn up your radio, and enjoy this near hour of spirited readings by your friends, neighbors, and other notables. Seattle's Favorite Poems 2014 was hosted by Town Hall Seattle on September 18th. The presenters included Seattle Arts and Lectures, Poetry Northwest, Hugo House, and the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for this recording.
Hello, everyone. It's great to see you. I'm Marcy Silman, and I have been given the great honor of welcoming all of you to Seattle's Favorite Poems and this special evening with Robert Pinsky. This event, Seattle's Favorite Poems, is based on the Favorite Poem Project, which is Robert Pinsky's initiative launched when he was the 39th Poet Laureate of the United States. A little bit more about that in a moment. This spring, the organizers of this event called for submissions of favorite poems from poetry lovers, and from the entries they received, tonight's participants were invited to read their favorite poems. Seattle's very first favorite poem event took place right here at Town Hall. The date was March 17th, 1999, and I didn't know that. That was the first public program in the space, which is so cool. It's great to be here all these years later. At that event, Seattle poet Heather McHugh was there. She opened to introduce Robert Pinsky, and there's nothing like coming full circle. Heather McHugh is here tonight to introduce once again. Please welcome Heather McHugh.
Thank you, thank you. Only now I need a cane. As you've heard, Robert Pinsky's first Seattle Favorite Poem event marked the reincarnation of this gorgeous structure as a cathedral of arts and inquiry years ago, 15 years ago, I am informed, a blink in an elder eye. And ever since that night, Town Hall has proven a rare and luminous attraction for Seattle. I wanted to thank everybody who created and continues it. Yeah. It's always a little unnerving, a live audience. It's the adjective, I think. One can't help worrying when it'll go off. Or maybe it's just as I'm always reminded, because Pinsky has a diabolical sense of humor, I'm always reminded when I'm in his company of Stephen Wright lines for some reason. And maybe it may just be that the uneasiness is the one that Stephen Wright meant when he said, "There's a fine line of difference between fishing and standing there looking like an idiot." Of course, he also said he went fishing with Salvador Dali, who used a dotted line, he said. and caught every other fish. But we've got bigger game tonight. I've known Robert Pinsky since we were both whippersnappers, and you've known him ever since you first channeled the witches of Wikipedia. So let me tell you something about him that you won't find in the usual curriculum vitae. The nuns arose in my mind as a prodigious rebuke. This is a man who steps up to help when aid and honor are called for. He makes poetry a gift to civic life. His will to good is prodigious and his love of senses wide. But best of all, his incapacity for public lies is live and kicking. That means Pinsky's art doesn't smack just of sweetness and light, as lay people often think poems must do. Sorrow and rage and more as well must be attended to, if one would tell it right. Even bitterness, as it turns out, is instrumental, something to be seen through, seen to, used for cuts, pressed into sharper service. And this is partly because the inner life of conscience registers as pain, not only unconflicted gift. It is the double sense of care. But where a conscience seizes up, a music moves. And you haven't seen this poet till you've heard him. One of the greatest gifts of his later years has been his jazz performances as well. Best of all, he looks for the music in us. This ain't some darling decorator of a nation's hopes, some harbor master of a hackneyed hull. He gives us sound more vexed and venerable, voices tender and tormented, rising from our hobbled memories and hobbled prospects, subatomic insights and colossal insecurities, now and then the whoop of a kid playing stickball. He's of at least two minds, the passionate, life-longing one, and then the other one, describable in Pinsky's own considered phrase as cautiously elegiac. Yes, so much the better. The adverb is the wise man's double take. Willing but wary, looking back when moving forward, it's an Orphic marriage between energy and elegy, both brightened and broken, both highlit and lost. Given these gifts of memory and musicality, Pinsky has the balls, not just the mortarboard, to sing of underworlds. There's a person here in a tiara I probably just offended. He's never merely been above it all, this man I promise I'm about to introduce. He knows to descend from the marble halls into the street again, down to the town and country mall, the commerces and zoo, to cast his lot with the rest of us monkeys. He comes to the sapient say and do with a regal rag and a raging reminder, not singing for his supper like the chimps on chains. He sings for fate, for fear, and for the ones who cannot sing, the great dead and the little dead. Let others tell you what he's been, the pedagogue of pedagogues, most discerning of jazz fans, most charming of granddads. I will tell you what he is for me. He's one of the few, I think, who deeply understands why I had to start up Caregifted, for example, for caregivers. He's unlike so many poets who have met with fame and haven't run from it, without a doubt, the most unselfish friend. I'm proud to welcome back to Town Hall and Seattle and affectionate acclaim again, the one and only Robert Pinsky.
My cup runneth over. I'm grateful to Heather and to you all. This is a moving evening to me for things it epitomizes. This project, I hope you all go to favoritepoem.org, and you'll see the Cambodian-American kid reading a Langston Hughes, the construction worker reading a Whitman, as these people will read poems tonight. The main thing the evening is about is the joy of art. It's about the pleasure of collaborating with the author of a poem and feeling it in your own voice. But let me, partly moved by Heather's eloquence, I hope about 17.25% of it is true. Let me say another thing that, among others, this evening is about, and that the project is about. It's about the fact that the human animal is completely dependent upon the past. We need, the animal could not survive. The famous tag, the claws are inadequate, the teeth are bad. It communicates not only with its peers, despite its inadequate hide and its poor weapons, it thrives and dominates, sometimes as a catastrophe for the world, because it gets information from the elders and it gives them to the next ones, the young. So this is partly an evening and a project about giving voice to the past for the future. It has to do with that generational thing of the first two or three or four poems we're going to hear tonight. I noticed that, as in those favoritepoem.org videos, very often the living reader is saying the words of someone no longer with us. To my grief, my dear friend Seamus Heaney is not with us, and Wisława Szymborska. Other times we'll hear living poets. But an essential, central part of human intelligence is not just memory, but communication between the past and the present. The living, we are living temporarily, and our gravest, most important responsibility is to the past and the future. We are supposed to take what the old ones gave us, and it's not enough to preserve it in formaldehyde. We have to change it. We have to take what the old ones gave us and do something different with it, and give it to the young so they do something different with what we give them. In that spirit, I'm going to read my poem, and then we'll hear from the main part of the evening. The poem I'm going to read to you is a poem by Robert Hayden, the first African-American to have the post that later became Poet Laureate of the United States. And I read Hayden's poem as a father and a son, thinking about the familial version of what I just tried to express to you. And I read it as a poet, and I fall in love every time I read the poem with the way a certain formality in the language. Polish my good shoes as well. Not also polish my good, or polish my good shoes, to polish my good shoes as well. And not nobody, no one. And that decorous element in a very intimate family portrait is part of what, for me, makes the poem so moving, because as a father and as a son, I know that these relationships, in my understanding, are never perfect. So I'm going to begin the reading of poems by reading Robert Hayden's Those Winter Sundays, and then we will immediately begin to the poems and readers that you have in your program. Those Winter Sundays. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then, with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices? Thank you. Here comes the poetry.
My name is Faye Jones, and I'm a painter. And I will read Auden's Musée des Beaux-Arts. And I think I feel as though I'm a caretaker of this poem because it's a poem about a painting, about a story. And I feel as though I'm part of sort of a circle with this particular piece of poetry. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position. How it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course anyhow in a corner, some untidy spot where the dogs go on with their doggy life and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had to on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on. Thank you.
My name is Jessica Jigo, and I'm going to read Digging by Seamus Heaney. And I first found this poem when I was in high school, and I fell in love with it because I loved how he talked about his father and how he was comfortable being very different than his father, but also appreciating what his father did. And I've reconnected with this poem later in life, having found agriculture. And as a first-generation farmer surrounded by very large potato farms, I find a lot of comfort in this poem, and I just am in awe of how he talks about the land. So, Digging. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father digging, I look down. Till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug, the shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf. Digging. The cold smell of potato mold, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it. Thank you.
This looks like my size mic. My name is Cindy Engelhart, and my poem is by Wieszawa Szymborska, the 1996 Nobel Prize for Literature Award winner. She's Polish. And this poem speaks to me of all the random befallings and why I'm here and why we're here and so many of our other people are not. This poem is called Could Have. It could have happened. It had to happen. It happened earlier, later, nearer, farther off. It happened, but not to you. You were saved because you were the first. You were saved because you were the last. Alone, with others, on the right, the left, because it was raining, because of the shade, because the day was sunny. You were in luck, there was a forest. You were in luck, there were no trees. You were in luck, a rake, a hook, a beam, a break, a jam, a turn, a quarter inch, an instant. You were in luck. Just then, a straw went floating by. As a result, because, although, despite, what would have happened if a hand, a foot within an inch, a hair's breadth from an unfortunate coincidence. So you're here, still dizzy from another dodge, close shave, reprieve, one hole in the net, and you slipped through. I couldn't be more shocked or speechless. Listen how your heart pounds inside me. Thank you.
My name is Carrie Williams, and the poet that I chose is also a former poet laureate, and it's Billy Collins, and the poem that I chose is Snow Day. And I first read this poem way back in 2001 on a service I used to be registered for called Poem of the Day, where you would get an email in your inbox with the poem in it. And I remember the exact day that this poem arrived because I loved reading it. And what I loved about it was it's a poem about the weather, which is familiar territory for so many poets. But the language that this poet used to describe the snow was not serene or bucolic or any of the peaceful things we think of in a weather poem, but the snow is described as anarchic and upheaval and disruptive, and there's many warlike images associated with it. And I grew up in Arizona where we don't get snow. And so my experience of living in Seattle and experiencing snow is that it is a disruption and an upheaval, and it does sometimes feel like the weather is conspiring against you and that you might be its prisoner or you might be its willing accomplice, depending on whether you are stuck in traffic or you are at home with no place to go. And that is what is happening in this poem. And by being at home and having no place to go and listening to the radio, the poet also gets an unexpected insight into another world, which is a world where children are maybe hoping for a snow day and the radio is listing school closures. And it causes him to imagine a world which had been previously hidden to him. And what is especially awesome about this poem is that those revolutionary images that start the poem carry all the way through to the last line. And this is Snow Day. Today, we woke up to a revolution of snow. Its white flag waving over everything. The landscape vanished, not a single mouse to punctuate the blankness. and beyond these windows, the government buildings smothered, schools and libraries buried, the post office lost under the noiseless drift, the paths of trains softly blocked, the world fallen under this falling. In a while, I will put on some boots and step out like someone walking in water, and the dog will porpoise through the drifts, and I will shake a laden branch, sending a cold shower down on us both. But for now, I am a willing prisoner in this house, a sympathizer with the anarchic cause of snow. I will make a pot of tea and listen to the plastic radio on the counter, as glad as anyone to hear the news that the kitty corner school is closed. The ding-dong school, closed. The all-aboard children's school, closed. The hi-ho nursery school, closed, along with, some will be delighted to hear, the toadstool school, the little school, little sparrows nursery school, little stars preschool, peas and carrots day school, the Tom Thumb Child Center all closed, and, clap your hands, the Peanuts Play School. So this is where the children hide all day. These are the nests where they letter and draw, where they put on their bright miniature jackets, all darting and climbing and sliding, all but the few girls whispering by the fence. And now I am listening hard in the grandiose silence of the snow, trying to hear what those three girls are plotting. What riot is afoot? Which small queen is about to be brought down?
Hello. My name is Maya Chenen, and I will be reading Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. My mother loves this poem. She has always emphasized to my sister and I how important kindness really is. And in the hardest seasons of this 17-year-old life, this poem has always reminded me of her. So this is Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved. All this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows, and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend.
My name is Phyllis Rosen, and I am reading a poem by Wallace Stevens called Someone Puts a Pineapple Together. This poem was given to me as a gift from my father. He thought that I, since childhood, I was a person that put my own pineapple together in my own way. So it's really hard to understand, so get ready. That's why I need glasses. Oh, I guess I should tell you what I like about it, though. Being a chef, I work with food, and I particularly like the way different fruits and vegetables cut and reveal themselves. No one else has ever seen that slice of a cabbage or the inside of this passion fruit or this pineapple. And much like my soul and spirit, or your soul and spirit, you get to open and individuate in a way that only you can do. And Wallace Stevens is kind of talking about that in his high language and excellent use of it. So excuse me if I mispronounce anything. Someone puts a pineapple together. O juventes, o file, he contemplates, a wholly artificial nature in which the profusion of metaphor has been increased. It is something on a table that he sees, the root of a form as of this fruit, a fund, the angel at the center of this rind. This husk of Cuba, tufted emerald, himself may be the irreducible X at the bottom of imagined artifice. Its inhabitant and elect expositor, it is as if there were three planets, the sun, the moon, and the imagination, or say, day, night, and man, and his endless effigies. If he sees an object on a table, much like a jar of the shoots of an infant country, green and bright, or like a venerable urn, which from the ash within it fortifies, a green that is the ash of what is green, he sees it in this tangent of himself. And in this tangent, it becomes a thing of weight, of which the weightless rests, from which the ephemeris of the tangent swarm, the chance concourse of planetary originals, yet as it seems of human residence. He must say nothing of the fruit that is not true, nor think it less. He must defy the metaphor that murders metaphor. He seeks as image a second of the self, made subtle by truth's most jealous subtlety, like the true light of the truest sun, the true. Power in the waving of the wand of the moon, whose shining is the intelligence of our sleep. He seeks an image certain as meaning is, to sound, sound's substance and executant, the particular tingle in a proclamation that makes it say the thing it says. Below the pejorative jumble, the fruit so seen as a part of the nature that it contemplates is fertile with more than changes of the light. On the table or in the colors of the room, its propagations are more erudite, like precious scolia jotted down in the dark. Did not the age that bore him bear him among its infiltrations? There had been an age when a pineapple on the table was enough. Without the forfeit scholar coming in with his enlargings and pale arrondissements, without the furious roar in his capital, green had those days its own implacable sting. But now a habit of the truth had formed to protect him in a privacy in which the scholar, captious, told him what he could of there where the truth was not the respect of one, but always of many things. He had not to be told of the incredible subjects of poetry. He was willing they should remain incredible, because the incredible also had its truth. Its tuft of emerald that is real for all, its invitation to false metaphor, The incredible gave him a purpose to believe. How thick this goblet is with overlays, the double fruit of boisterous epicures, like the same orange repeating on one tree, a single self, divest reality of its propriety, admit the shaft of that third planet to the table, and then one, the hut stands by itself beneath the palms. Two, out of their bottle the green genie come. Three, a vine has climbed the other side of the wall. Four, the sea is spouting upward out of the rocks. Five, the symbol of feasts and of oblivion. Six, white sky, pink sun, trees on a distant peak. Seven, these lozenges are nailed up lattices. Eight, the owl sits humped. It has 100 eyes. Nine, the coconut and the cockerel in one. 10, this is how yesterday's volcano looks. 11, there is an island Palahud by name. 12, an uncivil shape like a gigantic haw. These casual exfoliations are of the Tropic of Resemblances, sprigs of Capricorn, or as the sign demands, apposites to the slightest edge of the whole, undescribed composition of the sugar cone, shiftings of an inchoate crystal tableau, the momentary footings of a climb up the pineapple, a table alp, and yet an alp, a purple southern mountain bisque, with the molten mixings of related things, cat's tastes possibly, or possibly Danish lore, the small luxuriations that portend, universal delusions of universal grandeurs, the slight incipiencies of which the form, at last, is the pineapple on the table, or else an object, the sum of its complications, seen and unseen. This is everybody's world. Here the total artifice reveals itself as the total reality. Therefore it is, one says, even of the odor of this fruit that steeps the room quickly than not at all. It is more than the odor of this core of earth and water. It is that which is distilled in the prolific ellipses that we know. In the planes that tilt hard revelations on the eye, a geometric glitter, tiltings as of sections collecting toward the greenest cone. Thank you.
I am Karen Clark, and I'll move up a little bit closer so you can hear me. I grew up in a family of performers, and it never occurred to me that there was something unusual about my family until I became an adult, because we were the type of family where people would suddenly burst out in poems and song, and, you know, it was sort of like, let's put on a musical every night. And the other thing that didn't occur to me was I also grew up in a family where we protested, and I was 36 years old before I realized that not everybody stands up for what they believe in, and not everyone is willing to go out into the streets and say, this is what I feel is right. And not everybody takes up every fight because it has a moral cause. I blame this on my mother. My mother was originally from Kansas, and we were raised first in Europe and then in New York City. And it was very important to her that we understand some things. And after I became an adult, I truly came to appreciate my mother's parenting style, because she wasn't one of those parents who said, this is what's right. She didn't dictate, but she used a variety of forms to teach us. And so one of the things that we did almost every night was poetry. And I'm the youngest of three children, and my siblings are a little bit older than I am. And from the time I was really small, I wanted to be like them. And so I started reciting poems at a very early age. And the poem I'm going to recite for you, or read to you rather, is I Too by Langston Hughes. And for me, this poem holds a very special place because it was the first poem that I recited in a public place. And it was also the first time that I discovered the experience of accidentally hushing a crowd. I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes. But I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I will eat at the table when company comes. Nobody will dare say, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I too sing America. Thank you.
I'm Addison Richards, and I'll be reading Allen Ginsberg's Supermarket in California. What thoughts I have of you tonight, Walt Whitman, for I walk down the side streets, under the trees, with a headache, self-conscious, looking at the full moon. In my hungry fatigue and shopping for images, I went into the neon fruit supermarket, dreaming of your enumerations, what peaches and what penumbras. Whole families shopping at night, aisles of husbands, wives in the avocados, babies in the tomatoes, and you, Garcia Lorca, what are you doing down by the watermelons? I saw you, Walt Whitman, childless, lonely old grubber, poking among the meats in the refrigerator and eyeing the grocery boys. I heard you asking questions of each, who killed the pork chops, what price bananas? Are you my angel? I wandered in and out of the brilliant stacks of cans following you and followed in my imagination by the store detective. We strode down the open corridors together in our solitary fancy, tasting artichokes, possessing every frozen delicacy, and never passing the cashier. Where are you going, Walt Whitman? The doors close in an hour. Which way does your beard point tonight? I touch your book and dream of our odyssey in the supermarket. I feel absurd. Will we walk all night through solitary streets? The trees add shade to shade, lights out in the houses. We'll both be lonely. Will we stroll dreaming of the lost America of love, past blue automobiles and driveways, home to our silent cottage? Ah, dear father, Graybeard, lonely old courage teacher, what America did you have when Chiron quit pulling his ferry and you got out on a smoking bank and stood watching the boat disappear on the black waters of Lethe? Thanks. I love this poem partly because of how I found it. I was at my university audio lab and checked out the album. I didn't get to take it home. He had to take it into a closet with a speaker and a turntable and a chair. I got out my Walkman recorder and I strapped it with duct tape to the speaker because I knew it was going to be good. I listened to it, and the album starts off with Howl, which is recorded live, and it's this giant, encompassing, cacophonistic, you know, masterpiece. And it's kind of like a dream. And it's being read by somebody down a hallway, and no matter how fast you run, you can't get down there. And followed by that is a footnote of Howl, which is kind of the religious rantings of a madman. And then you get to a location, a stage that's much more intimate, it's much more close, it's much more warm. It's the 1950s American ideal of the local grocery store. And I know that not everybody here has had the chance to walk the streets at dawn totally out of your head. I'm pretty sure that everybody's been to the grocery store. And it's just really nice to set it in there. My second favorite part about it is actually the part about being followed by the store detective. Because for a short while, I spent some time as a poet, and I found myself wandering through stores and through crowds, kind of, if you will, a little differently than everybody else, kind of outside, just like he says, shopping for images, kind of pickpocketing emotions from people as they walk by. And you're not doing anything wrong. You're not loitering. You're hard at work, but you're definitely not like everybody else, and you're definitely up to something. And, you know, maybe, hey, I'm writing poetry is only the answer that the only answer you need. And in the end, Alan looks at Walt, and he says he wonders what America he sees. And now we can look back at Walt, or at Alan, and wonder what America he saw. And maybe we can figure out that their America of love is still there. We just need to take a celestial poet out for a walk at night and see what you find. Thank you.
My name is Linda Norlin, and I'm going to be reading In the Waiting Room by Elizabeth Bishop. I love this poem. In it, the 7-year-old Elizabeth experiences her connection to everyone else and everything, but at the same time, she has this queasy feeling that everything is rather strange, and this is a feeling that I often had when I was younger. And just how odd the world is, our being here, doing what we do, or as Bishop says in the poem, how unlikely. In the waiting room. In Worcester, Massachusetts, I went with Aunt Consuelo to keep her dentist's appointment and sat and waited for her in the dentist's waiting room. It was winter. It got dark early. The waiting room was full of grown-up people, arctics and overcoats, lamps and magazines. My aunt was inside what seemed like a long time, and while I waited, I read the National Geographic. I could read. And carefully studied the photographs, the inside of a volcano, black and full of ashes. Then it was spilling over in rivulets of fire. Osa and Martin Johnson, dressed in riding breeches, laced boots and pith helmets, a dead man slung on a pole. Long pig, the caption said. Babies with pointed heads wound round and round with string. Black, naked women with necks wound round and round with wire like the necks of light bulbs. Their breasts were horrifying. I read it right straight through. I was too shy to stop. And then I looked at the cover, the yellow margins, the date. Suddenly, from inside, came an O of pain. Aunt Consuelo's voice, not very loud or long. I wasn't at all surprised. Even then, I knew she was a foolish, timid woman. I might have been embarrassed, but wasn't. What took me completely by surprise was that it was me, my voice, in my mouth. Without thinking at all, I was my foolish aunt. We were falling, our eyes glued to the cover of the National Geographic, February 1918. I said to myself, 3 days and you'll be 7 years old. I was saying it to stop the sensation of falling off the round-turning world into cold, blue-black space. But I felt, you are an I. You are an Elizabeth. You are one of them. Why should you be one too? I scarcely dared to look to see what it was I was. I gave a sidelong glance. I couldn't look any higher. At shadowy gray knees, trousers and skirts and boots, and different pairs of hands lying under the lamps. I knew that nothing stranger had ever happened, that nothing stranger could happen. Why should I be my aunt, or me, or anyone? What similarities, boots, hands, the family voice I felt in my throat, or even the National Geographic and those awful hanging breasts? What held us all together or made us all just one? How? I didn't know any word for it. How unlikely. How had I come to be here, like them, and overhear a cry of pain that could have got loud and worse, but hadn't? The waiting room was bright and too hot. It was sliding beneath a big black wave, another and another. Then I was back in it. The war was on. Outside, in Worcester, Massachusetts, were night and slush and cold, and it was still the 5th of February, 1918. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Michael Wells, and I'll be reading Poem by Frank O'Hara. I love everything about Frank O'Hara. I love his accessibility, I love his grace, I love his humor. But one of the things I love most is that he is a city poet and writes about cities. And in fact, his biography, City Poet by Brad Gooch, is a great, great biography of his fascinating life. I'd also like to say that when Robert Pinsky was first our poet laureate and first published the America's Favorite Poems book, I was in a bookstore on Broadway that I managed and then owned, and one of my fellow workers became a closest friend. And she has a poem in the book, a John Ashbery poem, and today is her birthday. So I'd like to say happy birthday to Katie by reading Poem by Frank O'Hara. Lana Turner has collapsed. I was trotting along, and suddenly it started raining and snowing, and you said it was hailing, but hailing hit you on the head hard. So it was really snowing and raining, and I was in such a hurry to meet you, but the traffic was acting just exactly like the sky, and suddenly I see a headline, Lana Turner has collapsed. There is no snow in Hollywood. There is no rain in California. I have been to lots of parties and acted perfectly disgraceful, but I have never actually collapsed. Oh, Lana Turner, we love you. Get up.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Chung. I'm going to be reading Suicide's Note, an Annual by Mary Carr. I love this poem because Mary Carr wrote it about a man that she loved, but the poem itself is snarky and angry, and it kind of disagrees with having loved him. And I think that's what I like about it, that it disagrees. Suicide's Note, an Annual by Mary Carr. I hope you've been taken up by Jesus. Though so many decades have passed, so far apart we'd grown, between love transmogrifying into hate, and those sad letters and phone calls, and your face vanishing into a noose, that I couldn't today name the gods you at the end worshipped, if any, praise being impossible for the devoutly miserable. And screw my church, who'd roast in hell poor suffering bastards like you, unable to bear the mask of their own faces. With words, you sought to shape a world alternate to the one that dared inscribe itself so ruthlessly across your eyes. For you could not, could never fully refute the actual or justify the sad heft of your body, earn your rightful space, or pay for the parcels of oxygen you inherited. And more than once you asked that I breathe into your lungs like the soprano in the opera I loved, so my ghost might inhabit you and you ingest my belief in your otherwise only probable soul. I wonder, does your death feel like failure to everybody who ever loved you, as if our collective CPR stopped too soon? The defib paddles lost charge. The corpse punished us by never sitting up. And forgive my conviction that every suicide's an asshole. There is a good reason I am not God, for I would cruelly smite the self-smitten. I just wanted to say ha-ha. Despite your best efforts, you are every second alive in a hard, gnawing way for all who breathed you deeply in. Each set of lungs, those rosy implanted wings, pink balloons. We sigh you out into air and watch you rise like rain. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ellie. I'll be reading The Quiet World by Jeffrey McDaniel. And this is my first favorite poem. I heard it when I was 12 years old, and it's the first poem that I ever got, which was really thrilling for a 12-year-old. I heard it in a science fiction writing class, and I love it because it's a dystopian future, it's got implausible government regulation, but it's also really human and has a lot of that sentimentality of what it means to be a human. And then I'm going to tell you the rest of what I like about it afterwards so that you understand what I'm talking about. Okay, The Quiet World by Jeffrey McDaniel. In an effort to get people to look into each other's eyes more, and also to appease the mutes, the government has decided to allot each person exactly 167 words per day. When the phone rings, I put it to my ear without saying hello. In the restaurant, I point at the chicken noodle soup. I'm adjusting well to the new way. Late at night, I call my long-distance lover, proudly say, I only used 59 today. I saved the rest for you. When she doesn't respond, I know she's used up all her words. So I slowly whisper, I love you, 32 and a third times. After that, we just sit on the line and listen to each other breathe. So, A, it's great, and B, I think it's a great thought experiment. I love the idea of thinking about our words being so precious, and we have to be so considerate about who we give them to and who we withhold them from. And I like to think of a world where everything that we say is important, and just all of the clutter falls away. But at the same time, think of all the important things that we lose. So I like to think about now, when I reread this poem, who would I give my words to? What would I say? I also really wonder, when you say I love you 32 and a third times, what that third is. And I changed my mind about what that is, so I'll leave it up to you.
I'm Barbara Johnstone. The poem that I'm going to read is a new poem for me in the last year. I have reached a point in my life where I don't want to hold back at all. I don't want to hold myself back. I want to really go with my passion. I want to really be in my body. I want to be just totally present. And this poem helps me do that. I could not read this poem and be in my shy, reticent self. And it's also a poem that is, there's parts of it that make no sense at all, logically. So it gets me out of that part of my brain. And it also has these images in it that are just really strong and really feminine. And those have been separate for me a lot in my life. So it's really nice to bring them together. This is a poem called Dithyram of a Happy Woman by Anna Swer. Song of excess, strength, mighty tenderness, pliant ecstasy, magnificence lovingly dancing. I quiver as a body in rapture. I quiver as a wing. I am an explosion. I overstep myself. I am a fountain. I have its resilience. Excess, 1,000 excesses. Strength, song of gushing strength. There are gifts in me, flowerings of abundance. Curls of light are sobbing. A flame is foaming, its lofty ripeness is ripening. Oceans of glare, rosy as the palate of a big mouth in ecstasy. I am astonished up to my nostrils. I snort. A snorting universe of astonishment inundates me. I am gulping excess. I am choking with fullness. I am impossible as reality.
Hi, I'm Margaret Duffy, and I'm reading a poem by Derek Walcott called Love After Love. And in thinking about what I love about this poem, I think it's the feeling that I got when I first heard it, and a feeling I've had with all my other favorite poems that I've collected over the years, that I just got the answer to a question that I hadn't figured out how to ask yet. So this is Love After Love. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror. And each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life.
Hello, I'm Richard Groomer. I'm here to read you a poem tonight by W.S. Merwin that he wrote early on in his career. He published it in 1956. This poem's been with me for a long time. I was drawn to it by the beauty of its language and its imagery, but it stayed with me all these decades, actually, because of the subject and what it addresses, what is important. The mountain. Only on the rarest occasions, when the blue air, though clear, is not too blinding, as, say, for a particular moment just at dusk in autumn, or if the clouds should part suddenly between freshets in spring, can one trace the rising slopes high enough to call them contours, and even more rarely see above the tree line. Then it is with almost a shock that one recognizes what supposedly one had known always, that it is in fact a mountain. Not merely this restrictive sense of nothing level, of never being able to go anywhere but up or down, until it seems probable sometimes that the slope, to be so elusive and yet so inescapable, must be nothing but ourselves, that we have grown with one foot shorter than the other and would deform the levelest habitat to our misshapen condition, as is said of certain hill creatures. Standing between two other peaks, but not as they, or so we have seen in a picture whose naive audacity, founded as far as can be determined on nothing but the needs of its own composition, presents all three as shaped oddly, of different colors, rising from a plane whose flatness appears incredible to such as we. Of course, to each of us privately, its chief difference from its peers rests not even in its own centrality, but its strangeness, composed of our own intimacy with a part of it, our necessary ignorance of its limits, and diurnal pretense. That what we see of it is all. Learned opinions differ as to whether it was ever actively volcanic. It is believed that if one could see it whole, its whole shape, it might make this clear, but that is impossible. For at the distance at which, in theory, one could see it all, it would be out of sight. Of course, in all the senses in which any place or thing can be said not to exist, until someone at least is known to have been there, it would help immeasurably if anyone should ever manage to climb it. No one, from whatever distance, has ever so much as seen the summit, or even anywhere near it. Not, that is, as far as we know. At one time, the attempt was a kind of holy maelstrom, Mecca for fanatics and madmen, and a mode of ritual and profane suicide, since among us there is nowhere from which one could throw oneself down. But there have been expeditions even quite recently, and with the benefit of the most expensive equipment. Very few who set out at all seriously have come back. At a relatively slight distance above us, apparently, the whole aspect and condition of the mountain changes completely. There's a ceaseless wind with a noise like thunder and the beating of wings. Indeed, if one considers the proximity of the point at which so much violence is known to begin, it is not our failure that strikes one as surprising, but our impunity. The summer camps on near gradients, ski lifts in winter, and even our presence where we are. For of those who attained any distance and returned, most were deafened, some permanently, some were blind. And these, often incurably, all without exception, were dazzled as by a great light. And those who perhaps went furthest and came back seemed to have completely lost the use of our language. Or if they spoke, babbled incoherently of silence, bursting beyond that clamor of time, past there, not passing here, which we could not understand, of time, no time at all. These characteristic effects of the upper slopes, especially the derangement of time sense and the dazzling, seem from earliest antiquity to have excited speculation. One legend has it that a remote king priest figure once gained the summit, spent some, to him, non-sequent, but to them, significant time there, and returned shining, bearing ciphers of the arcane, which translated into the common parlance, proved to be a list of tribal taboos, like clastic specimens, and behaved with a glacial violence later construed as wisdom. This, though charming, does not, in the light of current endeavor, seem possible, even though so long ago. Yet to corroborate this story, in the torrent, gold has been found, which even at this late date, appears to have been powdered by hand. And further to confuse inquiry, several pediments besides, each with four sockets, shaped as though to receive the hoof of a giant statue of some two-toed ungulate. Legend being what it is, there are those who still insist he will come down again someday from the mountain. As there are those who say it will fall on us, it will fall. And those who say it has already fallen, it has already fallen. Have we not seen it fall in shadow, evening after evening, across everything we can touch? Do we not build our houses out of the great hard monoliths that have crashed down from far above us? Shadows are not without substance, remind and predict, and we know we live between greater commotions than any we can describe. But most important, since this is all we know, it is not whatever it makes us believe of it, even the old woman who laughs pointing and says that the clouds across its wing face are the wings of seraphim. Even the young man who's standing on it declares it is not there at all. He stands with one leg habitually bent to keep from falling, as though he had grown that way, as is said of certain hill creatures. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Aidan Lang. Obviously British, as you hear from my accent, and I'm going to read Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken. You may think it a bit impertinent for a Brit to read a piece of classic American literature, but I was told that I'm the new general director of Seattle Opera, and I'm told that my illustrious predecessor, Spate Jenkins, on this very stage, read a Shakespeare sonnet, so I thought... Exactly. The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveller. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other, as just as fair and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaths no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less travelled by, and that has made all the difference. Now, now, I was being rather flip to say it was about picking some American literature, because actually this poem has really featured in my life in three very significant moments, and all of them seem to touch into the essence of what Frost is saying. But I first encountered it with this venerable Penguin paperback. I was 15, and I've dated it from this. And it was in school, and Frost was one of the poets we were studying. And on the front and on the back, unusually, the designers have put the oil painting of Robert Frost, which is in Amherst College in Massachusetts. So his elderly presence dominated my understanding. And also, we were played, probably unwisely, a recording of an elderly Frost reading this poem in a very elegiac, wise way. So as a 15-year-old, I assumed that what it was about was I took the one less traveled by, that life has the decisions at all stages, but as a young man who was thinking about going into the arts as a career in some way, to have the courage of my convictions, etc., etc. Cut to about, I guess, 5-6 years later, and I'm at university studying English literature and drama. And again, American literature features as a course, and of course this Frost came up again. And I suppose I was still colored by the image of a poet on the book, and I heard his voice in my mind. And I guess the student-tutor relationship kept that there, except then I realized, or I thought I realized, that the poem was about the way that although we make decisions throughout our lives, looking back with old age, we realize there is, in fact, a pattern to this. And then I guess I put it away for 25 years until 2006, when I was appointed to the job of general director of the opera company in New Zealand. And I was packing up my house, and things had to go. We had too much stuff to fit in a 40-foot container. And you're going to hate me for this, but something I'd never done before, I actually gave away a lot of books. They simply were not going to fit in the container, and you know, I'd kept books. I'd never ever given one away, but I reasoned that in New Zealand isn't the Sahara, and if I wanted to reacquaint myself with Mrs. Gaskell, I would be able to buy a copy. So I was culling away like Nero, and then came across this, and I don't know why, but for some reason, I think it chimed in with the fact that I was moving my family across the other side of the world. By taking that job, I was giving up a career of 30 years as an active stage director of opera. And I realized I had made a decision, but didn't know if it was the right one, which path really I had taken. And I browsed through the book as well, and of course stumbled across The Road Not Taken. And I applied a logic which, as a stage director, I used to do always when researching an opera, was to work out what the circumstances of the composition were. So I looked again, and lo and behold, the secret lay one page earlier, where the collection mountain from which the poem comes, Mountain Interval, has a date, which is 1916. And I realized, actually, he wasn't the elderly man or the guy with a gravelly voice on the recording. He was about 42 when he wrote it. So I looked at it again and realized that I completely missed the point as a student, that in the last stanza, he's actually giving a sly dig at our kidding ourselves that there is a pattern to life, that he's saying when we're old, we'll say, you know, we'll romanticize it and say we stood to our ideals and there really was a pattern, whereas there I was at 48, 49, on yet another forked path, having no idea whether the path was correct or not, and realizing that would indeed be, that is the reality of how we exist. So when I was asked to do this, and I had been in Seattle for 8 days, the book had survived the cull. I didn't cull a gull, don't worry, when I came to Seattle. It just struck me that here I am again at this age. I still don't know what the path I've taken now, what it will lead to. And probably, hopefully, if I live to a longer age, I'll look back. Will I know that that has made all the difference? Probably not. Thank you.
I told you so. I told you this would be good. And I am going to add one more poem. It is a two-line poem. It is by the 17th century poet Ben Jonson. It is to the reader. This is the poem. Reader, take care that takes my book in hand to read it well. That is, to understand. These people have done that. I'd like to invite them to please stand up while we clap our hands off.
That was former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky. Last month, Pinsky returned to Seattle to celebrate the 15th anniversary of Town Hall's inaugural event, a reading of Seattle's favorite poems. This event was hosted by Town Hall Seattle on September 18th, 2014. Thanks to Town Hall, Seattle Arts and Lectures, Poetry Northwest, Hugo House, and the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. And thank you to Anna Tatashev for this recording. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, you'll find the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. You'll also find links there to all of tonight's poems. You can always podcast this program using your favorite aggregator, including KUOW's mobile app. And last but not least, if you absolutely love the series, please give us a good review. It helps more people find us. Thanks for listening. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.